and a very good morning out there, everybody. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer, your guest host for the day. I don't know if I'm a guest host or not. There's three of us that do this show, Dr. Merkel, Dr. Yaley, and myself. So I'm the one you get today. And I have a variety of topics to share with you. I'm trying to figure out how they're all going to tie together, but they will, because we're going to talk nutrients first. We're going to talk lab testing like we always do. And if you've never listened to this program ever before, I want to welcome you in. Thanks for turning us on this morning. Maybe you're listening as you cruise around in the Miami Valley. Maybe you've joined us in an online format via cell phone, tablet, computer on WHIO.com. If you missed the beginning of this show, which is only 30 seconds old, you can always grab the podcast later on. It'll be on the WHIO website. It will also be on our clinical website shortly. But take2healthcare.com is how you find us on the web. And if you want to call today to ask a question and be live with me on the show, the number to do that is 937-957-1290. Now, when I was here about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I gave you the old phone number. So I promised I wouldn't screw that up today. So 957-1290 is our new phone number here at the studio. If you want to call and ask questions, get on the air with me. And if you don't, Dalton's standing by. He can take your question. He'll write it down for me, and we'll cover it as we come back from the other side of the break. But diving into the first topic of the day, And like I was mentioning just a moment ago, if you've never heard our program before, what you can typically expect during this hour on a Saturday is hearing about the patients we take care of in our practice. And that is Take Two Healthcare. We're located in Centerville or Washington Township, more accurately, right on State Route 48 in between Whip and Ron Roads in the Royal Swiss Village. Phone number to call us at the office is 937-433-3241. But we have a clinical nutrition practice. We're also doctors of chiropractic. I have an advanced certification in chiropractic acupuncture as well as my board certification in clinical nutrition. And what does that mean? How does that help people? Well, I was associated with a group of like-minded business people trying to develop their business acumen over the last year. And I had a couple of people in that group say to me, I don't know who it is that you help. And they said it in an inquisitive way. I appreciated the question. And I said, well, really, we can help anybody who's interested in looking in the mirror at their health care and doing it in a more natural sense. So that's who we really help. Not necessarily those that are on 15 or 20 medications that are considering trying to go down to 18 or 17 medications, but those that really want to take a hard, cold look and what's going on in their bodies. And when I say we take a hardcore look, we do that through third-party verifiable lab testing data. There are no strange peripheral techniques that we're using. There's no muscle testing that gets done in our office. Certainly when we're evaluating a chiropractic patient, we will do assessment of muscle strength from a purely orthopedic and neurological standpoint. But there's no vials of this or vials of that held to your body to test the strength of your shoulder muscles to give me information about how your adrenals and kidneys are functioning. That is not what we do. In our clinical nutrition practice, we are what Dr. Merkel refers to as straight nutritionists, where we will sit down with a patient, we'll take a proper intake, and we will order laboratory testing. And I have no vested interest in the outcome of those tests, but I need those numbers in order to put together a personalized or individualized approach to help patients no matter what their diagnosis is. And one of the things I wanted to share with the listeners out there today is if you go to our website at take2healthcare.com, under the resources tab, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 over from the left in that first landing page, you go over to resources and you scroll down 3 spots and you click on the word case studies. Under that part of our website, we have listed out many of the different types of patients that we've worked with successfully. And we give you, in those case study sketches, the laboratory data, the starting points, the points in the middle, and some ending points at the time we wrote up these studies. And so kind of just to run through and give you a broad overview of some of the patients we work with, one of my first ones here that I did was acute pancreatitis. actually caused by medications. We knew that because the patient went in to see their doctor, and their doctor immediately had them stop several of the medications they were on. And then from there, we took over the case and got him back to healthy in about 2 months. Improved his energy, decreased his urinary frequency, and also dropped down his pain and inflammatory levels too. That's the first case study on the website. We've got Alzheimer's disease, ankylosing spondylitis, anxiety and poor concentration. There's a great breast cancer case. You've heard Dr. Merkel talk about this one on the program here. Crohn's disease, diabetes and blood pressure, fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue together combined. They're two different conditions, but this particular patient had both. Heavy metal detox, really good results that we can get from getting the body cleaned up. Other cancer cases that we worked with, kidney and liver cancers, liver inflammation, low testosterone levels, menopause and insomnia, even men's hormone balance. So, you know, I think we get a lot of buzzy clips in our inbox from Instagram and YouTube about women's hormones being this hot button topic. And certainly it is. But some of the guys out there having hormone balance problems too. And that could be for a variety of reasons, including cholesterol deficiency. So that was another one of the topics I wanted to share with you today. Again, on our website, under that same resources tab, if you go one further down from case studies and you click on newsletters, when you do that, you can then go to the search bar on the side and you can put in any topic that you want to see if we've written a newsletter on. And in this particular instance, I typed in the word cholesterol because I remembered writing several of these newsletters a few years back. And there is about three or four different hits there. Actually, there's quite a few more than that. But there are several great newsletters that we've put up on our website about the cholesterol theory, high or low, good or bad, those kind of topics. And really wanted to just put that out there for you so you could look it over in terms of arming yourself with information. Because the next time you walk into your medical doctor's office, they may be all over you about a cholesterol level that might say 203, 205, 208, somewhere pretty close to their line of 199 or below. And unless you take a step back and look at a little broader sense of the findings in terms of, we got to look at HDLs, so the heart healthy cholesterols. We need to know what those are. If out of your 208 total cholesterols, you have 104 of those of the good kind or HDL, then that's going to make your coronary risk down around 2, which, as long as it stays below 4, puts you in that probably protected category from heart attack and stroke risk. And that's just one sense in looking at that data. There's actually an even better number that we use on almost every patient we test called C-reactive protein. They did a 30-year-long study of nearly 25,000 women in Europe. They followed them for 30 years to determine that the C-reactive protein blood levels were the single most powerful predictor of heart attack and stroke risk in their bodies. So the next time you go in to get a standard physical, know that you're only getting about 15 to 18 key blood values assessed. And on our standard testing, there's 58 just to begin. That's if we don't even add hormones and cancer screening and advanced coronary panel. I mean, we could easily look at 75 to 90 different blood values for you all in one swoop, where you just get one assessment there. Thank you, Dalton. And question from a caller. What is the best form or route of administration for magnesium? And can it cause magnesium burns? Okay, interesting question from a caller that did not want to come on the show today, but that's a great question. And for magnesium, we need to know a little bit more about the goals of what the patient's trying to accomplish while taking magnesium, because there are different forms of magnesium that do different things in the body. And so one of my favorite forms to use is called magnesium with malic acid, or magnesium malate, because it's a highly absorbable form. It's got basically all the steps already taken care of for your body to take it, drop it right into the chemical reaction needed to help start utilization of that supplement. So there are other good types too. We like magnesium glycinate. We like magnesium citrate in certain cases, but if the goal is to be keeping the bowel function steady, having a daily bowel movement or evacuation of waste, then magnesium with malic acid wouldn't be the best choice in that department, because magnesium with malic acid doesn't go and stimulate those bowels to continue to move. It does it by a totally different pathway. Now, magnesium glycinate is also very gentle on the stomach, so it's not going to cause or contribute to diarrhea. But magnesium citrate is one that's often utilized in both standard and natural medicine to get the bowels to move. So it really depends on what the goal is with magnesium supplementation. For me, I like to test a patient's blood and hair levels on magnesium first to determine what their real true need is. And we may end up seeing a scenario like this. Blood levels normal on magnesium, hair levels showing an elevated output of magnesium level. Now, what does that mean, elevated output in a hair test? That means the body is utilizing some of that additional magnesium that it had stored in the cells to actually connect or bind to a toxic heavy metal like arsenic, lead, mercury, aluminum. So it'll bind to those heavy metals and actually flush it out of the system, therefore leaving the hair test value a little bit high, but potentially leaving the body a little bit deficient in that magnesium level. Now, that's why it's beneficial to see both the blood level and the hair level on each particular patient, so we know exactly how much they need. So, for example, with magnesium with malic acid, our particular tablets have 125 milligrams of magnesium in them. So we might give two, even three daily. It might be a common usage for us, and it is a common usage for us, but only if the patient demonstrates a need based on their objective testing. It's not about me determining their magnesium need other than me interpreting their test for them. But really, the magnesium choice to be made depends on the problem that we're trying to address. Now, the question of magnesium burns is always possible, I would say, but it really would be hard to do. I've never seen it in a patient. I've never seen that kind of issue happen, because if we test for the patient's need and then we know exactly how much to give and we come back several months later to determine their changing magnesium needs, I don't see any problem with that, because if we're looking at those levels on the pre and post supplementation level, we're going to catch problems before it becomes a bigger issue. And so I know there's a reaction that occurs in chemistry with the burning of magnesium, but that's really not an issue that we see if given in proper supplemental form, and especially when there's testing done prior to giving that to a patient. So the other thing to consider with magnesium is it's the fourth most common nutrient deficiency on the planet. So we look at all people on this globe, and the scientists that are paid to study this stuff have followed trends for decades worth of data and come down to the understanding that magnesium is deficient in the fourth most common clip amongst all people on this planet. So just with that knowledge alone, 85-90% of our patients probably do need magnesium, but still the testing helps us with the personalized need, because not all patients are the same, and no two patients are going to have the same requirements, even based on their size. If we're treating a 120-pound female versus a 285-pound male, there's going to be different recommendations. And it's not just based on their size. It's based on their size and their lab testing data. Might be even based on their blood pressure values. It might be based on their heart rate, because magnesium does have a wide variety of how it positively impacts the health of the overall system. So we just need to know exactly what the needs are. We're going to take a break. Dalton's been giving me that eye, which says, let's take a break right now. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And perfect, we are back. Thank you very much. Dalton and I were having a quick chat at the break about magnesium. Just some continued thoughts to wrap that one up before we dive into CoQ10. But if the issue was that the bowels weren't moving properly or regularly, then magnesium citrate would be the choice there. But typically in our practice, because of our use of vitamin C, fish oil, and other essential fatty acids, if you will, those those nutrients also help to keep the bowels moving. So chlorella too. And people often think magnesium, but it's not just magnesium. It has to be the very specific form if that's the goal and the need. And the other piece about that that's important is magnesium and calcium need to be in a fairly balanced ratio of about a 2-to-1 comparative ratio. So if we're giving 1,000 milligrams of calcium to a particular patient, maybe for bone mineral density support or based on their other laboratory findings, we're going to want to couple that with about 400 to 500 milligrams of magnesium. There's different research that shows the ratio can be 3-to-1, 3-to-2, and even 2-to-1. I've seen all three of those different scenarios written in the research. So it doesn't really matter what the research says across the board as much as it applies to each particular patient on their testing. Because if you read the article and it says, oh, you need magnesium for this, this, and this, and you just put yourself on it, but you're already high in magnesium, that's kind of defeating the purpose to a degree. It's not going to give you any weird problems for the most part, but it might not be necessary. So wouldn't you rather funnel your money and your time and your intention into doing something that you actually know you need to do rather than just kind of shotgun approach? And Dalton's comment was great. We use this at the office too. He said, you got to test or you're just guessing. And I said, yeah, that's exactly right. We tell patients that, because if I come into the room and I just start talking to the patient, I start making all these thoughts in my head about what they're probably deficient in, I'm not going to hit it right in most of the cases because I'm not paid to guess. I'm paid to analyze testing and order the proper testing and then interpret it and use it for future data points so that we can make sure we're getting the progress we expect. Now, to transition just very briefly, and I know I don't have near enough time to do this justice, but on our website under my bio, there's an article I wrote, I don't know, 6 or 8 years ago now, that was published in one of the nutritional journals, and it's on CoQ10. And the reason I bring that up today is I saw a patient yesterday for chiropractic care, and she has a sciatic nerve problem due to a bulging disc in her lower back, and she's also been newly placed on a statin drug. Now, if you are up to date on your drug-nutrient interactions and drug side effects, you'll know that most statin drugs contribute to lower CoQ10 levels in the body. And they do that because of how they impact the liver. The liver is this storehouse and manufacturing center for virtually any and every vitamin conversion that goes on in our body. But specifically, CoQ10 is manufactured in the liver. And some of these cholesterol drugs go to the liver and make it sick enough so that it doesn't make new cholesterol, but at the same time knock out the CoQ10 production to a large degree. Now, why is that important for my musculoskeletal patients? Well, because if you have leg pain, nerve pain, soreness upon waking in the knees and hips that are not documented to be osteoarthritic change, there could be a reaction from your medications that's driving some of that nerve irritation and pain running down the leg, that referred pain. Now, I know there's a multitude of complex factors involved in each case, but one of the things we're going to experiment with on this patient that I saw yesterday is we're going to add in CoQ10 while she stays on her lower dose of statin therapy, and then we're going to hopefully be able to get her musculoskeletal complaints taken care of in an even faster way. So the article's online for your reading pleasure. I joke when I give lectures around town that if you're having trouble sleeping, give that a good read and you'll probably go right to sleep. Unless you're really, really interested in the topic. Read it first thing in the morning when you've got plenty of energy. I know we're going to take a break. We've got a caller waiting. Hang on. We'll be on the other side of the break to grab you. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer today for Take 2 Healthcare, your guide to better living on WHIO. Live with Dr. Andrew Dyer. That is me. And I'm going to take a caller right away here. Let's see if this works out. Dave, you're on with Dr. Dyer. How can I help you? Dave, can you hear me? Dalton's going to help me here. I don't know where Dave went. Check one more time for Dave. Nope, we don't have him. I don't know why, but he's not there. We can try again later. But before we do anything else, I want to give you some info about the kind of patients, again, that we work with and how we impact multiple diagnoses that they have. And the patient that I consulted with this week, she's been a patient for a long, long time. And over the last 3 to 4 years, she's been dealing with a diagnosis of multiple myeloma, which is a particular form of cancer. And along with her standard medical treatment, she's continued to follow many of our nutritional recommendations, my nutritional recommendations for her. And we've seen a lot of quality improvement in her test results in that time. So looking at even vitamin D status from last year to this year, she was actually at a point last year where her levels were a little bit too high. And that is possible with vitamin D. You can get too high. It's a fat-soluble nutrient, so we don't want to exceed about 100 nanograms per milliliter in the blood. And so we actually had to pull her supplementation level on vitamin D3 down a little bit in order to get her back to a healthier place. We also reduced her levels of inflammation, notably with the ESR, the SED rate. That one dropped from 23 down to 2, which is the lowest, healthiest version of that number. So there's a multitude of diagnoses that we work with. Pretty much any diagnosis is fair game to work with outside of us being the primary or sole provider on cancer or HIV/AIDS. Now, I've worked with the patients that have that diagnosis too, but they need co-management in that case. But there's a lot of great things we can do to help them out. We're going to try one more time with Dave. Dave, you're on with Dr. Dyer. How can I help you? Dave, check, check. I don't know. It's not working, Dalton. Can't hear anything. Dave, check, check, check. Nope, Dave's not there. We'll try again. We're trying to get to Dave, but we're having a difficulty here. I want to jump in and give you another answer to a question that a patient wrote in with this week. And she's a long-distance runner. She trains frequently by running 6, 8, 10 miles almost on a daily basis. She runs half marathons competitively and regularly places or wins her age group. She's in her mid-30s. And she wanted to know my opinion about using collagen support to help with tendon and soft tissue repair in her body. So she has dealing with another injury. I don't know exactly which tendon injury she has at the moment, but I can tell you in what I looked at over the weekend for research, there are quite a few studies that mention the usefulness of providing collagen support to reduce levels of inflammation in the body and to help accelerate healing. But their limitation is if there's a complete tear in say, for example, the Achilles tendon, then you can take in all the collagen in the world and it's not going to put that completely torn tendon back together. That's not how it works. And if there's a completely torn Achilles tendon, that's a surgical repair. Now, there's a lot to be done before that and after that to help get the patient back on their way quicker. But as far as what the research shows, vitamin C is named the C, the big C that represents vitamin C's name, has been given to it because it helps with collagen formation and collagen acceleration in the body. So giving something like a dose of 4,000 to 6,000 milligrams of vitamin C to those patients dealing with soft tissue injuries can accelerate their healing, provided they don't have a completely torn tendon. Now, on the collagen level, we use a nutrient at the office called Baxyl. Baxyl is hyaluronic acid. That's one of the forms of collagen. It's extracted from, in this case, chickens. So it's taken from animals, and it is then used as a supplement to be given to joint patients. So joint patients, those with knee, hip problems, ankle problems, shoulder issues, because all those heavy-duty joints of the body have a layer of cartilage made up of collagen. Now, there's a number of other ingredients, if you will, in that cartilage too, but it's made up of water, it's made of proteoglycan layers, which is, we get support from our essential fatty acids like fish oil and other supplements that way, but there are a number of different ways to go about helping to support those mechanisms of injury as well as to catapult healing and repair to happen. But my suggestion there would be, if you're dealing with a soft tissue injury and you're a long distance runner, you've got to address all factors. So there may be a need for testing on the level of on the level of protein deficiency too within the blood. And so if that's the case, we need to take a deeper dive into the blood work to find out not only are you needing collagen and vitamin C support, but what are your other needs? Maybe there's nutritional deficiency leading to anemia or B12 deficiency, which also slows down healing. Maybe there's some gut disruption, which is again going to slow down healing and repair. So as a factor of zooming in to that one injured joint, yes, we need to do that, but then we need to zoom out and take a look at the body as a whole as well. Let's try one more time here with Dave. Dalton's going to help me. Dave, you're coming through live. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, Dave, we got you. What's your question, man?
Okay, great. Okay, well, I just had a question about a good nonstick frying pan. I mean, I've heard you talk about them some time ago, and I forget what you said. Sure. Is there any good nonstick healthy frying pans out there, or are we stuck with cast iron and stainless steel?
Yeah, so actually, great question. There are two brand names that I would have you do a little additional research on. One is called the Always Pan. That's one that I use at my house. My wife and I found that after some research online. So the Always Pan is one good option. Now, on that one, you can't cook it on any higher heat than medium. So it does limit your use on that to a degree. But then there's another company that produces clean. So what we're looking for here is aluminum-free cookware. That's the biggest connection with how we're going to stay as healthy as possible with our cookware. The other one is called Green Pans. Green like the color, and then P-A-N-S. So Green Pans and the Always Pan. Those are two good companies to do a little research on when you're looking for cookware. They do have nonstick options. The Always Pan, again, you can't cook higher than medium, and you do need to have some good, healthy cooking oil in it as you turn it on. You don't want to season the pan by just heating it up with nothing in it. So we use commonly at my house either avocado oil, olive oil, coconut oil, depending upon what we're cooking, and typically medium or lower is going to get the job done there. So, yeah, check those two out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Yeah, good. Sorry, that was a crazy little technology glitch there, but we got Dave, and he got his question answered. Curcumin's the other topic for the day, and I know we've been bouncing around like crazy, but it's more enjoyable. It's more exciting. Every couple, 5-3 minutes, we got to change the topic because it's more exciting that way. It's for me, too. I don't want to just drone on and on about curcumin the entire show, but curcumin is a highly beneficial nutrient across the board in virtually all scenarios of helping the body control inflammatory levels. Now, you can find negative things about curcumin when you do a little quick online research. But in my experience, you'll find far more beneficial things about curcumin when you do your online research. So there's a drawback to everything, if you will. But if you get tested properly and you use curcumin properly, you can get some great benefits. And we've been using curcumin for a long time in the office. And there are a couple of specific things to really try to include in any good supplement that contains curcumin. Now, this was a social media trend probably 2 to 4 years ago where they said, you gotta have black pepper or the ingredient from black pepper called piperine in the curcumin in order for it to work best. Now, initially, some of the formulations that we were using didn't have that, and we are still getting great results. But now, since we've gone and actually assembled our own private label version of curcumin complex, which contains ginger, turmeric, and curcumin, those three active ingredients tend to work best when coupled together because it's hardly ever as easy as just finding one nutrient deficiency that the body lacks. It's typically a much more broad scope and broad spectrum. So if we give curcumin, turmeric, ginger all in the same tablet, and we might give 4 to 6 tablets daily depending upon the patient's need, how tall, how much they weigh, what their blood pressure is, but we use it with the purpose of reducing inflammatory levels. And how can that help? Well, it helps by when we reduce inflammation, typically we help with pain. There was a great study that came out where they compared curcumin to diclofenac. Diclofenac is a medication used to bring down inflammatory levels. There's a cream form of it called Voltaren, and I do like limited topical use of that, maybe for a day or two's time if you have a really, really sore joint that you're trying to get out of the woods. But if you'll do the underlying things, which is support that healing and repair process with a nice natural anti-inflammatory like curcumin, then the results are better. In a laboratory study, they found that curcumin equaled and exceeded in the group that they were studying, comparing them to the drug use, the diclofenac group. 28% of people taking diclofenac had severe GI issues, and they had to take a second drug to alleviate those. Whereas if curcumin was the only one used, it was easy and gentle on the stomach. And for this purpose of this study, they were given 500 milligrams three times daily. So 1,500 milligrams total for the day is what most studies say. It's kind of an entry-level use for that particular nutrient. Now, they actually know by looking at inflammatory levels, such as, again, the one we mentioned earlier, C-reactive protein, those were reduced by 74.81% in the curcumin group alone. And in the curcumin group, 18% of patients experienced more than 50% symptom improvement, with 3% improving by 70% or more. Okay, a little confusing on those data points there, but the long and the short of it is the curcumin study group outperformed the one even when they combined curcumin with the medication. It was the curcumin alone that actually had a higher level of ranking for beneficial effects to the patient. Now, curcumin is an unbelievably vast nutrient in terms of how many small chemical parts are contained in the curcumin molecule. I've seen it stated in other research articles that there may be upwards of 300 to 400 active biochemical molecules in curcumin. And so far, we've only studied about 19 or 20 of those. So there's a much, much needed lack of further knowledge and understanding in the laboratory research to expand out our knowledge on curcumin. We already know a ton of stuff about curcumin and how useful it is and can be, but there's still need for further research because it will help to bring more of that information to the forefront when good quality studies are published. Now, here's another key element to looking at any of those kind of studies. We also have to know who's paying for the study. Because if the study's being paid for by the same company that's making the product, that's not as reliable of a study as it needs to be because they have a vested interest in the outcome. So it needs to be done by an independent research agency, whether it's a university. Much of the research on these type of products and compounds comes out of Europe. They have a little bit more emphasis in their world over there on natural healing methods, much more so than we do here in the States. But there's great research that comes out of these European universities all the time telling us how important some of these bioactive molecules and compounds are in things like curcumin, in things like CoQ10, in things like fish oil. And like I was telling you before, when you pop on your favorite Facebook group and start reading some of the things that are being posted there, it's not all going to be a rosy picture every time. Prepare yourself for that. That's also probably not where you need to be getting your information from. But just to put that out there, I have many patients each week that come in and tell me about what they found in their Dr. Google search. We all do it, right? We have symptoms. We want to know the answer to them. And so we type it in on a search. That can be detrimental even to mental health because if we don't test properly, we really don't know if we actually fit in that group. I was talking to a nurse yesterday. She's a patient. And she said, well, I've got this particular diagnosis, and she rattled it off. And I said, okay, well, how do we know you have that? She said, well, I did a test for it, and I also looked it up online, and I have all the symptoms. I said, okay, well, that's great, and you might well have them. But until we have a verifiable lab test, it's going to be difficult to know if the diagnosis is correct. Now, I remember I went through a lot of these pathology classes too, and as we read about different conditions, as we study these named problems that afflict the human race, you start to identify with some of them like, oh, low energy, brain fog. And I'm not saying I have these things, but these are the common listed symptoms under many of the pathology categories. And you can start to talk yourself into some of these things until you do verifiable lab-based analysis to say, oh, Yeah, my suspicion was actually incorrect in this case. My vitamin D level is optimal at 87. And I had a patient that told me, he was listening to my show, very first show I did this year, back in January. And he said, I am here today because of what you said on your show in January. And what I said was, if it's been more than 2 years since you've had a blood test, make it a goal in 2026 to get another one. Because I guess the question is, what the heck are you waiting for? You got to get checked or you're just guessing. We're going to take our last break. We'll be back after this. You've been listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And we are back. Thank you very much. The final stanza here today, Dr. Andrew Dyer with you for just a few more minutes. We had another caller that needed some help with answering a question on how to reduce PTH levels in their blood. Now, PTH stands for parathyroid hormone, and the diagnosis there is hyperparathyroidism. Now, in this particular case, there may not be much to do from a nutritional supplement standpoint in the beginning, because more often than not, when this condition develops, it's because of nodular formation on the parathyroid gland. And so imaging needs to be done to consider if that's part of the picture or not. And then we need to understand some of the underlying causes, which may be related to even certain medications that the patient may have been placed on. So thiazide diuretics used to lower blood pressure. And even lithium, which is given to patients that have manic depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, those can actually drive calcium and the PTH level up higher in the blood. So if we can really kind of come to an understanding on what's driving this number higher, then there may be some natural options for it. But imaging first to rule out tumor formation is a high priority. Sometimes there will be a biopsy needed of that parathyroid gland, but imaging happens first. If there's nothing found on the imaging, then you're not going to go poking into it with a needle. But if there's a need for a rule out on whether that tumor's benign or not, then biopsy may be the only way to get that information. Now, the important piece there is understanding the role that the only job the parathyroid has in the body is to help regulate calcium levels. So its literal only job is to turn on or turn off calcium production and storage in the blood. When that's not happening correctly, then we start to see complications like bone loss, maybe even kidney stone formation, although we shouldn't blame kidney stones on just calcium excess every time. Because even though 90% of kidney stones do have calcium in there, it's not always the culprit for how they got there in the first place. If you're drinking 44 ounces of Mountain Dew three times a day, that's why you got kidney stones. It's not related to how much calcium you have or you don't have in your blood. That's just plain and simple logical thought process. But if the problem is an elevated PTH level in your blood and you're looking for ways to help reduce that, I've had several cases that we've worked on where this number can get better over time. But sometimes the medical testing is key in an initial sense to figure out exactly what we're dealing with. All right, good. I can catch my breath now. We're finishing our last few seconds. Thanks for tuning in this morning. I know it was a rainy, kind of weird spring summer day out there, but hopefully you spent an hour with us. If you missed the program today, go back and catch it on the podcast, either on our website or WHIO.com. And you've been listening today to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290, News 95.7, WHIO.